Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to Free Market Underground, where every week we bring you all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager for Butler Lands and Wagler. Free Market Underground is produced every week by Mr. Martell Love, and the show is sponsored by Butler Lands and Wagler. Good morning. Merry Christmas, Martell Love.
Merry Christmas, Chris Butler. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Man, you guys, Jeff Bolton's show in the mornings, fascinating at how it has come to elicit such a response from listeners. It's awesome. Great show.
Was a great show. Good week.
Want to thank you for an outstanding year. I guess you will be on vacation next week. So next time we talk, meet, will be 2018. Thank you for an outstanding year of production. I appreciate that. Martell knows things that, honestly, not that I couldn't learn, but it would take me years to learn what Martell does, and he does it so well. Why would I want to learn?
Well, I appreciate that, Chris Butler, and there are things that you know, absolutely, that I definitely don't want to learn. So.
Right.
And I'll let you do what you do, and I'll do what I do.
You know what they call that in economics, Martell?
What's
they call it the division of labor.
Yes.
We specialize in something.
You do is much more valuable than what I do.
I'm not sure about that. At least yours has some kind of technical proficiency requirement.
That's true.
And that is
make
the
me
way
feel of, better about it.
That's
Chris.
Right. That's the way of the future, my friend. You're on the right side. All right. This show, and Merry Christmas to everyone on Monday.
You have big plans for Christmas, Chris?
Big plans, but not to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Here in town. We'll stay here in town. How about yourself?
Yeah, same here. Staying here in town, hanging with family here.
Yeah,
got
all
the
your
gifts ready for all my children.
That's right. And all your family's here, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Majority.
Yeah, the same here. I mean, 80% of my, 90% of my family is here in Kansas City. So
yeah.
We don't have to. And chances are you and I probably will be celebrating Christmas within a 5-mile radius. Because I think you live around where my dad lives. So I think we're probably going to be in the same stomping grounds this Christmas. And from what I understand, there's at least a small chance, Martell, that those stomping grounds will be filled with snow. Small chance.
It's about time, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It was coming eventually.
We have had absolutely no – I didn't know this until I heard it on the news this week. We have had no moisture, no rain, no snow – no precipitation since October 27th. We are now going on 60 days of no precipitation. So, yeah, a little white Christmas would be nice if that were to break up that streak. You know, because it's Christmas and things are kind of winding down for most people for the previous week as people are starting to think about Christmas and holidays and not working. A lot of people used last week, myself included, to kind of close out some things, some projects, run some errands. Didn't really have a whole lot of time to prepare for this show. I did prepare. But what I prepared is a little different. It's basically some vents, some things that have rubbed me the wrong way over the past couple of weeks or months. And I'm going to start this show with a quote from economist Ludwig von Mises, and I think it's appropriate. If one rejects laissez-faire on account of man's fallibility and moral weakness, one must, for the same reason, also reject every government action. Ludwig von Mises, if one rejects laissez-faire, which means hands-off, literally, on the account of man's fallibility and moral weakness, doesn't one also then have to reject every government action because man, whether he is operating in the private sphere or the public sphere, still carries with him fallibility and moral weakness? The reason I bring it up is because the tax bill, which was passed this week, you got a lot of feedback, obviously, from Democrats who have some problems with this tax cut and tax reform package. And one of the things that came to mind was that implicit in all of their complaints was this. We don't want you to be able to spend more of your hard-earned money. We want to spend it because we know what is best for the country. You don't. And there are a lot of people that vote Democrat or leftist-leaning parties, Democrats being the largest of them in the United States, based on that fallacious premise that the government, if people work in the government, they are free of what their problem is with the people that work in the private sector, which is their fallibility and their moral weakness. Somehow we are led to believe then, I guess, that if you choose to work for a government, you're an angel. And if you choose to work for profit, you're a devil. Of course, I am painting that in black and white, and it's not quite that black and white, but that's, in a nutshell, the way I interpret it. There's a guy named Tim Knight. He has a blog that's very well read, very well respected, and it's on markets, which is why I read it. And he wrote this the other day. I have kind of a problem with it. First, he did a back of the envelope analysis of the taxes paid by someone making $500,000 a year and living in a $3 million house in Palo Alto, California. He's from California, and he actually follows California real estate pretty closely. So it's no surprise that he chose to write about kind of a, I guess you would call them a tech entrepreneur, $500,000 per year, living in a $3 million house in Palo Alto, California. He found that after tax reform, this person would pay $29,000 more than before tax reform. And so he writes this, and I quote, and I apologize in advance for the length of the quote. Our poor hypothetical taxpayer has one more indignity to suffer between one, rising interest rates, and two, the loss of deductibility in state income taxes, three, the reduction of deductibility in mortgage interest, four, the loss of deductibility in property taxes. His house is going to sink in value as it dawns on people how badly they've been jobbed. He doesn't say jobbed. I'll put that in there. How badly they've been jobbed. So on top of massively higher expenditures to pay federal taxes, after all, someone has to pay for Bob Corker's tax cuts. He's making payments on a diminishing asset. Congratulations, America. You're not even sure what's hit you yet. End quote. And that seems, the reason I bring it up is it seems to that line of thinking seems to be prevalent amongst those that lean maybe just a little left. This is clearly the type of person that Mises is referring to. When we get to keep our money, there's no end to the evil that Pandora will unleash upon our society. But if the government spends our money on what they think is important, we ought to take annual sojourns to D.C. to touch, just merely touch a politician, like the faithful touch a 1,000-year-old Christian relic. Sorry, Mr. Knight, but humans create wealth, and humans in government first forcibly extract that wealth from the private sector, and then those humans, those fallible humans that work for the government, decide how best to spend it. And, of course, again, they too are fallible. And no, in case you're wondering, Knight has not waxed nearly as poetic about any Democrat profiting from this tax bill. And trust me, most Democrats will benefit because 80% of all tax filers will benefit. One unforeseen benefit of the tax bill being a long time in coming has been that it's allowed me to see the political stripes of people who used to do a pretty good job of hiding them. Downtown Josh Brown on CNBC is apparently a left-leaner. He is against the tax cuts. Why? Well, the deficit, of course. It's going to blow out the deficit. I must have read 10 stories from once reputable news sources on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all about the tax law. News stories, mind you, not blogs, not op-eds. And I have to tell you, I have lost respect for some of these organizations that seemed overly concerned with reminding their readers, these are news stories, that remind the reader that the individual tax cuts will go away in 2025 unless action is taken to make them permanent. It's as if these news organizations can't stand the fact that people will get to keep more of what they earn. They hate the idea so much that they want to dampen that enthusiasm for any tax cut by reminding people that, hey, it's going to go away. It's going to go away in 2025. 8 of the 10 news stories that I read seemed fascinated with the idea that the plan will cost $1.5 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. But check me on this. Was there a media outcry when the $800 billion politically inspired stimulus package of 2009 added the same amount to the national debt in 1 year? I don't think so. That's because the government, the angels, void of human fallibility, of course, got to dictate who would win and who would lose. We don't want that important step, that important function to be allocated to a market. Now, don't get me wrong. The debt is a problem. That's why I support selling assets to pay off the debt in its entirety tomorrow. We could do this literally in about 1 month. But to make sure the government gets paid fair value on these non-government funded assets, remember, you and I paid for them. Sure, take 6 months, do it right. Get fair value. Would the left and the media get as excited as they've led us to believe they'd be if we paid off all of the debt in 6 months and at the same time gave people their money back through this tax legislation? I'm sure they'd agree with me that since the debt is this huge problem, we must do what we can to make sure it never happens again, right? I mean, if it's that big of a problem, let's not only pay it off, let's make sure it never gets run up again. So to appease the left and the mainstream media, I'd suggest a national balanced budget amendment. And I'm sure there'd be universal appeal in that idea now that everyone's in agreement, clearly, on the dangers of the debt. But I do have to admit, it seems weird that the left and the mainstream media have only found religion with the ushering in of Donald Trump as president. I'm sure that's just politics, but a coincidence. But of course, it is politics. And all sarcasm aside, if the Republicans ignore the debt issue now, I throw them into the same group. Conservatives have been talking about the debt, and for good reason, for the last 8 years, if not 14. Remember, George Bush was no fiscal conservative. If they do nothing about the debt now, they will be made to look as foolish as the left, I think, in my opinion. And unfortunately, the blame for electing fools falls on you and me. We bear the brunt of the blame if this issue is not addressed. And, you know, and we need to take a break, but I will add this in conclusion, that in the last election, does anyone recall any serious ink being spilled, any serious oratory being made on the dangers of our debt? I do not, which is one of the reasons why I'm not confident debt will be addressed. But like I said, the fix, very, very simple. We need to take a break right now. When we get back, we're going to talk about a couple of other interesting rants, if I can call it that, pet peeves of mine, vents, et cetera. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 AM and 103.7 FM as well.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bells swing and jingle bells ring. Snowing and blowing.
Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we talk about all things boom and bust. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Just talk a little bit about the reaction to the tax bill that was not passed into law yet, but passed by everybody that matters except the president. So it looks to be a done deal. I wanted to shift gears, if we can, to a guy by the name of Bill Bonner. He and I share a lot of the same, I think, core political and macroeconomic beliefs. writes a well-read blog, and he came out with eight things and that to me seem like they lead into one of my interests over the past year or two, which is the illusion of prosperity in this country and the things that the Federal Reserve has done to facilitate that illusion. And he came up with eight axioms of the world as we know it now. And I wanted to read those to you because I think he does a much better job at articulating some of these things than I could ever do. And his first one is, real money must be connected to the real economy of energy, time, and resources. And for those of you that have been listening to me for a long time, reading my newsletters and missives, you know that I am of the Austrian School of Economics, a free market school of economic thought. And Bill Bonner here in talking about energy, time, and resources, those are some very Austrian themes. Now, traditionally, says Bonner, gold makes the connection between the real economy of energy, time, and resources to money. And in the case of Bitcoin, he says electricity is the connector. I happen to think that's a very weak connector, but I would agree that that's a connector nonetheless. Goes on to say, number two, time, energy, and resources are limited. Money must be limited too. Well, that certainly is an Austrian theme. Real wealth is based on real things. The feds can't command real wealth to increase, so they can't increase the supply of real money either. They can only increase the supply of fake money, the new elastic currency put in place in 1971. Number three, the financial world is cyclical, governed by markets and manias. The economic world is incremental and made up of real things. Markets can reverse suddenly. Prices can collapse. But firms, factories, and films rarely disappear. Number four, government is always a way for the few to take advantage of the many. While the rest of society engages mostly in win-win deals, the feds rely on win-lose deals. Controlling money is a way to force win-lose deals onto people, usually without them realizing how they are being flim-flammed. And that's Bonner's fourth axiom. I am reminded of, I guess you'd call him a philosopher, journalist, writer, H.L. Mencken, who I never tire of quoting or reading for that matter. He once said that, quote, every election is a sort of advance auction sale of stolen goods. No one ever accused Mencken of being an optimist. Let me read that again. Every election is a sort of advance auction sale of stolen goods. Bonner's fifth axiom, things have no inherent price or value. So true. Instead, markets discover what they're worth as people bid for them. If markets are not allowed to function freely, honest price discovery doesn't happen, and no one knows that anything is worth anything at all. We certainly don't know the true value of anything. People are bidding and making offers on stuff that they are confused about. Number six, interest rates should be discovered too, honestly, in a free market. Since 1987, the feds have diddled interest rates, forcing them down into the sweet mud of fantasy land where time runs backward and risks decline as time passes. That is a lot in one axiom that requires some unpacking. But the point is this, if you're going to manipulate prices, the one that will confuse the economy the most, the one price the economy depends on the most is the price of money. When you obscure the true value of money, you are asking for an economic quagmire, which is what this country has seen more or less since 1971. Number seven, driving interest rates down to ultra-low levels, the feds have falsified all asset prices. Driving interest rates down to ultra-low levels, the feds have falsified all asset prices. Why is that? Because every asset is discounted in some way, shape, or form using the risk-free rate. That's how you get net present value of everything. who controls the discount rate that's used in those calculations? The Fed. Keeping them low, the Feds have not only falsified all asset prices, they have driven up all asset prices. Eighth and finally, the Fed is reversing the policy of the last three decades. Instead of adding to liquidity, it is subtracting from it. By the end of 2018, the Fed says it will be draining about $600 billion a year from the U.S. money supply. Instead of pushing down interest rates, it is pushing them up. Instead of supporting the stock and bond markets as the world's number one buyer, it will become the world's number one seller. Now, this goes back a couple of months. This has been a major theme of mine. Global central banks have printed up a bunch of money, and it has found a home, mainly in U.S. stocks and bonds, but global stocks and bonds as well. Every global central bank has said they plan to at least back off, if not eliminate that, in 2018. If they are true to their word, and you are an investor, this is the one thing you ought to be watching. And it is one of the reasons I wanted to read Bill Bonner's, that you can hear someone else's opinion, not just mine. He too says that we ought to be very aware of the fact that the Federal Reserve, which since 2008 has put a bid under every asset, has reversed that. Now they're putting an offer in on every asset. Stocks, bonds, real estate, you name it. All right, we need to take a break right now. When we get back, we're going to continue talking about some investment themes, risk being one of them. You're listening to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust on KCMO Talk Radio 710 and 103.7 FM as well.
Boom, 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 boom.
Welcome back to Free Market Underground, where every week we engage you in thoughtful discourse about our economy and our markets. Merry Christmas. My name is Chris Butler, portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. One of the best things about doing this show in or around the Christmas season is that the station has access to some classic Christmas tunes, which Martel has been spinning for us this morning. All right, let's talk about risk. What I'm going to say in the first part of this segment, actually the whole segment, now that I think about it, going to make some of you uncomfortable. Not all of you, I hope, but I know it will some of you. And it has to do with risk. And I want you listeners at home to play along. Got a few questions for you that you can feel free to answer amongst yourselves. You don't have to share with the group. I'd like to ask a question about risk, and I'd like for you to answer it as best as you can. Here's the question. Let's say you're a sole proprietor. You own a one-employee business, and that one employee is you. You need health insurance. You're 50 years old. You have a spouse, two kids out of the house and on their own. Pretty much have to buy Obamacare insurance right now. It's expensive. It covers very little and has a huge deductible. Okay, so you're paying these huge premiums every month, and the first $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 of medical expenses, you will pay in full before hitting your deductible. For the last 7 years, you and your spouse have lived right. You exercise regularly. You eat a sensible diet. You drink alcohol only occasionally. You don't smoke. You've successfully avoided the opioid epidemic. Congratulations. You're both in great shape for your ages, but you've not actually had to use any of this expensive insurance that you've been forced to get. Well, now, as we all know, the new tax law eliminates the individual mandate. So the question is, will you or will you not go without health insurance? Now think about that for a second. If I just described you, let's all assume we are that 50-year-old. If you go without health insurance, I believe you're taking a huge amount of risk. Even if you continue to live healthy, you get hit by a bus tomorrow. Totally not your fault and end up in the hospital for, you know, any amount of time, but let's just say 2 months, which in that 2 months would probably include some pretty significant rehab services. To pay for a stay in a hospital now for 2 months, you'd have to pay about $150,000 out of pocket. And that's a home. That's a house. Can you cover that on your own? Canceling the insurance would indicate a complete, and this is my opinion, a complete lack of understanding of risk management. Sure, if you can't afford the insurance, well, you can't afford the insurance. And that's a pretty simple calculus. If you can't afford it, you don't get it. But if you can afford it, and I understand that all the pain incurred in having to write that check, that monstrously high check for health insurance premiums every month, are you going to cancel this policy? Because I think that would border on insane. And that is exactly what investors are doing today. I didn't want to steer this down the road of health insurance. It just happened to play into a general discussion about risk. This is the calculus that investors are having today. The market is up wildly this year, and people are eliminating, they're canceling their insurance. In investing, what is the insurance? Well, the insurance is diversification. People can't understand why they have, say, bonds when stocks are going to the moon. And here's your chance to finally get ahead, right? Just go right into a 50-50 portfolio split of Bitcoin and stocks. What could possibly go wrong with that scenario? What about this? And this is based on a true story. Let's say that you take out a loan against your house, which is paid for, and you take those loan proceeds and you go to Vegas. And you walk up to the first roulette table you see, and you place all your money on red. The casino employee spins the wheel, drops that little white ball into the wheel, and after about 30 seconds or so, the little white ball lands on red. You win, and you walk away. Now, what were the odds that you'd lose your money? Try to explain this to your children if you have any, or a friend if you don't. Will you say that there was a less than 50% chance of winning in that roulette wheel bet, and that this was a stupid and unnecessary gamble? Or will you explain that, in fact, there was no risk because, hey, you won? My point is this. Because you made a stupid bet, but won, does not mean that there was no risk. There was lots of risk that you'd lose a couple $100,000. We don't evaluate the presence of or the amount of risk based on an outcome. The outcome of any given bet has zero to do with how much risk was present. So why am I talking about this? Well, here's why. Because I have seen some absolutely ridiculous decisions made by investors this year. They are evaluating risk based on outcomes. If the market goes higher, well, that must mean there was no risk before. And then they start to question all of their risk mitigation techniques, or for investors, of course, that's diversification. Why am I diversified? Stocks are going up. If there was no risk, why have any asset class other than stocks? Let's go full stock, full Bitcoin. Investors who have increased their exposure to stocks, and I want to be clear about this, if an investor increases their exposure to the risky asset known as the stock market because the market went up, that was your rationale. The market went up, therefore I am taking more risk with stocks. If investors make that decision, I would say they are woefully, painfully uninformed about what risk is and absolutely clueless about how to interface with it. Investors who have increased their exposure to stocks because the market went up should not be managing their family's finances. They should be in certificates of deposit or some other means of protecting their families from their decisions. They are dangerously ignorant of market risk. Now, you might be thinking, surely there are times to take more risk than other times, and you would be right. But now is not that time. You don't increase your exposure to stocks and other risky assets while the Fed is hiking interest rates, markets are overvalued as they've been in 17 years, and the money printing is scheduled to end globally in the first half of next year. It's actually the exact opposite. It's the right time to curb risk-taking, not increasing exposure to risky assets. After depositing the family's savings in a CD, these investors should read about the distinction between smart money and dumb money. Dumb money succumbs to the fear of missing out on something. It's a very common and basic emotion. The smart money gladly sells the dumb money their shares. The smart money, that's institutions, hedge funds, pension funds, they're not the enemy of dumb money because the dumb money is its own worst enemy, destined to follow their emotions to buy at tops and sell at bottoms. Have you ever heard the axiom, if after spending an hour at a poker table, if you can't figure out who the sucker is, it's you? That axiom applies to investing also. Large institutions are looking around the table and they spot the dumb money as the sucker. The dumb money isn't even interested in looking around the table, which, by the way, makes them easy to spot by the smart money. If the stock market, and by that I mean the S&P 500, were to go up 50%, and that would be dramatic, over the next 12 months, and this is the key point, if the stock market from this point forward goes up 50% over the next 12 months, it will not mean that the assessment of risk today is wrong. It will mean the same thing as the guy who mortgaged his house to bet on red actually hitting red. The outcome tells us nothing about the risk in the markets today. And by the way, I'm not saying don't be in stocks. They're going up. You should be in stocks. We are. We're in stocks. I'm talking about the decision to add exposure to risky assets right now, going from, say, a 60% allocation of stocks to all in 100%. And I hope that makes sense. It probably doesn't apply to people who listen to the show because I am constantly amazed at how savvy the people who listen to this show truly are. But I bet you know somebody who needs to hear this because it is rampant. I mean, some of the investors interviewed on CNBC over the past year have utterly exposed themselves as illogical and irrational. To believe that because the stock market hasn't come down, I shouldn't have had any kind of risk mitigation technique in place is lunacy. And CNBC, shame on you for not calling these people out and saying exactly that. And sometimes it's hard to really get at what someone is saying when they're being interviewed because a lot of it is just kind of implicit, but it is still faulty logic. The outcomes have nothing to do with risk assessment. Just because this guy goes to Vegas, places his mortgaged house on the roulette wheel red, and it comes up red does not mean that wasn't stupid. It was. There was way too much risk that he would, you know, the bottom line is that his house was paid off. He then took a mortgage on it, so he gets locked into more payments for the rest of his life probably if he loses, but he won. And he was also, I said he walked away, and I said also it was based on a true story. He didn't exactly walk away. His sons followed him to, and I forget if it was Atlantic City or Vegas, to be perfectly honest. His family followed him and caught up with him after he had won and literally dragged him out of the casino before he made the same mistake and lost. So a little on risk is warranted when things are going good, because we'll talk about this in the next segment. Guess who's been getting out of stocks? At least for a month now. The smart money. We'll talk about it when we get back. We need to take a break. You're listening to Free Market Underground on KCMO Talk Radio 710, now heard on 103.7 FM as well. Welcome back to Free Market Underground, all things boom and bust, where every week we try to make a success out of our world. My name is Chris Butler, and I'm a portfolio manager with Butler Lands and Wagler. Last segment, we talked about risk, talked about Bill Bonner's axioms in the second segment, which I thought mimicked a lot of what we've been talking about for the past 2 months on this show. Sometimes it's better to hear it from someone else, someone more articulate, frankly, than me. And in the first segment, we talked a little bit about a quote by Ludwig von Mises that I thought applied a lot since Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, really, as the Democrats and the left have come out in force on the tax bill, against the tax bill. And I think that there are similarities in just about every argument against that tax bill. The one I am most sympathetic to is the budget deficit and the debt. We do need to address that. And you know, if you're a Republican, it's going to be very easy to address it. All you really need to say is that we didn't do it, but now we need to take care of it. And no one can really hold you responsible for doing it. And by the way, you know, I talked a little bit about paying off the debt by selling U.S. federal assets, but you don't have to pay it all off. I mean, it just has to come down to about 70% of GDP, and we're over 100% of GDP. So you get that down to about 70% of GDP or below, and you're giving your economy a fighting chance. I think right now what we're seeing with a better economy is really just a better mindset. I'm not convinced yet that we are actually producing more goods and services with any kind of sustainable activity. We are, however, feeling better about making goods and services, and that's good. One of the ways to make it a little bit more sustainable is to cut that debt down to a more manageable level. And it is a concern of mine. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the markets. And like we were saying in the last segment about risk, and this might interest you if you're an investor, since the 1st of December, the smart money has been using days where the market opens up to start selling to the dumb money from about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon to the time the market closes, and that's about 3 o'clock our time. Now, I have a chart posted that shows you the difference between what the smart money is doing and what the S&P 500 has done, and there has been a divergence. And when you see that kind of divergence, it means that the smart money is selling to the dumb money, and that the dumb money, frankly, is more eager to buy than the smart money is to sell. And so the market goes up in that environment. But the people with the money are not putting any more to risk. And this goes to what we were talking about in the last segment. They are saying, I want to take dollars off the table. Now, I'm not recommending you do that. I'm not recommending anything, frankly. All I was trying to draw attention to in the last segment was that there are a lot of people out there that have increased their exposure to risk. And it reminds me of a TV show I really liked to watch in high school and college called Hill Street Blues. And I don't know if any of you listening watched that show. It was well-recognized, won a lot of awards. But it was a show, if you don't remember, about beat cops in a fictional large city, which to me looked like New York City. It was probably filmed in New York City. Every week, the show would open up with a guy by the name of Sergeant Phil Esterhaus leading a meeting of the cops of Hill Street to let them know about all the crime in the area. The crime they needed to stop, crimes they needed to be aware of, murders, robberies, rapes, prostitution, etc. And he'd tell them what they needed to know and what they needed to be aware of with their safety in mind. And then he'd conclude each and every one of these meetings by saying, hey, let's be careful out there. It was a classic line, kind of a catchphrase of the show. It's been repeated a number of times in different contexts, but they're stealing it clearly from Hill Street Blues. I remember myself in the late 90s as my eyesight started to deteriorate, and unbeknownst to me at the time, I had developed cataracts. So the oncoming glare of car lights bothered my eyes, and I was involved in three traffic accidents in the span of about 6 weeks. But only one of them was deemed my fault. But I could have avoided, had my sight been better, I could have avoided the other two. Well, about that time, I was at my parents' house in St. Louis for Thanksgiving Day. And as I left to come back to Kansas City, my brother said, "Hey, let's be careful out there." And he was obviously referring to my accidents. And by the way, no one was hurt. And making a joke of it at the same time. But not making a joke of it, I now implore you, investors, hey, let's be careful out there. There are risks. There are risks you need to be aware of. And if you actually take a look at three, well, let's call them bear market triggers, we're actually okay, I think, in terms of the amount of risk that's out there, except for one. And you might make this the fourth, and that is what we've talked about ad nauseum, the fact that central banks will withhold, if we're to take them at their word, they're going to withhold liquidity. They're going to withdraw liquidity, in fact, by the middle part of 2018. And if you've been listening to the show for the last 2 months, I hope you understand by now the only thing that makes markets go up in aggregate, the stock market, for example, in aggregate, is money printing. That's it. There is no, forget the economy. There is no other reason for it, because without an increasing money supply, to buy IBM would imply that you are selling Microsoft. And so the index as a whole would go nowhere. There would be winners and losers, absolute winners, absolute losers. But when the Fed prints money, or any other central bank prints money, you can have relative winners. And technically, you don't have to have losers. And the whole stock market can go up at once. So that's the critical thing to watch, is money printing. It is absolutely imperative that we watch it. But I will mention this, two things actually about the market. Number one, bear markets are not triggered by duration. In other words, bull markets do not die of old age. I mean, as long as the Fed is printing money or some central bank is printing money that's making its way here, we can see that entire market go up. So that's point number one. There is no old age criteria. You do hear this is the longest running bull market. Usually the people saying that are saying, and we're due for a bear market. I guess from a purely statistical standpoint, yes, that's true, but it doesn't have to happen as long as the Fed is printing money or other central banks. But the other thing I want to point out is that, you know, if you look at price-to-earnings ratio, which is a multiple, a valuation measure of the stock market, stocks are horribly overvalued, terribly overvalued. But if you factor in the fact that with these tax cuts, that we're probably going to see about a 5-6% increase in profitability alone. Say nothing about the economy growing, but if we just cut somebody's taxes and the economy stays the same, you're looking at a 5-6% increase in profit, then that price to earnings ratio actually becomes less alarming. Still, I want us to look at price to sales, not price to earnings. That is, I think, what we need to see come down, because it is wildly out of this world. That is all the time we have for this week. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. Thank you, Martell. Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas. Until next week, have a great week.